Tweet at TodaySOR.
You're very welcome back to the programme. Now, the funeral is taking place this morning of two brothers, Brandon and Shane Skeffington, who died tragically at their home in Banada, County Sligo, last weekend. Joining us now on the line from Turlstrand is our North West correspondent. Oh, excuse me. I'm afraid we've just lost the link there to Eileen Magner. It's a tragic story. Hopefully we will be speaking to her a little later on in the programme about that. But now, let's go to the gathering. The topics this week: Gaza, the flight MH17, domestic politics, and of course Obama's remarks this morning about corporation tax here in Ireland. Now, I am joined for a look back at these and some of the other stories of the week by Constantine Gurdjieff, economist, by Christine Bowen, who's a journalist with the journal.ie, by Declan Power, who's a security analyst, and by Alison O'Connor, journalist and commentator. Good morning to you all, and thank you all very much indeed for coming into us this morning. We might start, I suppose, with what's going on in Israel and Gaza. Declan, I'll go to you first on that. There was an extraordinary strike on the school yesterday. I mean, we were speaking to representatives of the UN earlier on in the programme.
Yeah, I heard it.
They're still not blaming Israel. It seems fairly clear what they think,
yeah,
though, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it does. I suppose nobody's going to do something like that until they have something specific. And maybe there'll be a crater analysis of sorts taking place, and the munitions.
Would they be able to tell from that, Declan,
they would,
pretty
yeah,
soon?
Yeah, they would, yeah, fairly soon. I would be surprised if they weren't.
Do you think they'd know now already?
Quite possibly, and they're parsing it together and thinking of the politics of it. See, unfortunately, this is just another episode, but an even more vicious element in terms of how the information has been presented. I mean, it's depressing in a way. I was just thinking about it driving in. I was still in the army at the time when the Khanna incident took place in South Lebanon. Anybody in the Irish army who served in Lebanon in the 90s will remember this. This was when Israelis were firing a lot of munitions into Lebanon against Hezbollah at the time, and they hit a UN base where there were a lot of South Lebanese villagers sheltering. Now, they argue that they didn't do it on purpose, and they probably didn't, but this is what happens when you start flinging heavy ordnance into an area that's full of civilians. And it is quite unfortunate that the Israelis don't take a pace back. There's a sort of thing, peacekeeping theory, they talk about dissonance being one of, you know, of the protagonists, a dissonance from between them and reality. And both the Israeli regime and Hamas are complete examples of this. Both sides need to take a pace back and think about what's their primary objective, which is the security of their peoples. And neither the flinging of missiles by Hamas into Israeli territory is increasing, that's not increasing security for their own people, and the Israelis are not enhancing or securing their own people by responding with heavy munitions into Gaza. And unfortunately, the international community don't seem to have found a formula that will allow both parties back away to engage in some sort of dialogue at this point. Now, maybe this particular incident will cause a brief pause for the international community to be able to inject something that could allow some dialogue to take place.
It's very interesting looking at the way in which this conflict has been covered in Israeli media, and particularly the more right-wing aspects of it, obviously. But reading it, it's, from their point of view, it's very much the Israelis are under siege. You know, that they have one article entitled, you know, the horror of standing up to Hamas. There isn't much coverage of the Palestinian deaths. You can see how this is being perpetuated, really, if that's what the population are hearing all the time. Alison?
Yeah, but I think even in relation to coming on this morning and thinking about, you know, what do you feel about this as an individual? How do you express that? And how, in many ways, I think that the Israelis are so expert at their PR, and they're also so dogmatic.
Are they, Alison?
I believe they are.
It's very anti what they're doing at the moment.
Yeah, but you're still really, like, the bottom line is, I think what they're doing there is barbaric. I think there is absolutely no excuse, even before what happened yesterday. I think there is no excuse for the level of violence that they have used and for the amount of people that have died. And yet
in
I'm
fairness,
thinking...
You'd have to represent their viewpoint, which would be that
no, but
these
you see,
tunnels
you're doing,
have been created
you're
under
doing,
Gaza,
yes,
they're
but,
under attack.
But well, Keelan, you're doing the very thing that I'm going to make the point about, that if I sit at home and think, what do I think about this privately? That's what I think. And then I think, but oh, hang on. you know, the Israelis will come crashing down on people, that there is this whole, it is such, I think people feel bullied, basically, from not wanting to say exactly, I'm not saying it's right that rockets, that Hamas are sending rockets in, I'm not saying that.
Or that they're sending rockets that they're from saying, areas
I'm not saying I'm not saying that.
But what struck me,
I read this in the last couple of weeks, and this is Sir Gerald Kaufman, who's the MP, and this is something that he said in the House of Commons in February. He's Jewish, his family were seriously affected by the Holocaust. And he said, and this is before the current trouble, he said, my grandmother, the Nazis killed her in her bed, she was sick. My grandmother did not die to provide cover for Israeli soldiers murdering Palestinian grandmothers in Gaza. And that kind of sums it up for me, really.
It's quite emotive, though, in fairness, isn't it?
But it is emotive. Seeing children and seeing, you know, innocent bystanders, seeing the way the people in the Gaza Strip have been living. That's like, and ultimately, there's no logic there. There's no solution coming out of it.
But this constant bombardment is going on for years.
There is no solution.
Christine, I think that's the big problem, in that we're seeing, because of the leadership vacuum on both sides, we're not seeing any obvious endgame in sight. If anything, every day brings more of an escalation. There's no sign that Hamas is going to stop firing rockets. Israel isn't going to stop its attacks on Gaza, and any attempts at a ceasefire have floundered so far. So I think it's becoming increasingly clear that there needs to be some kind of intervention, but it's about where this intervention is going to come from.
If John Kerry can't speak to Hamas.
Exactly, and that's a huge problem. Yeah, exactly.
Well, weak John Kerry is.
Well, John Kerry has put forward a ceasefire proposal, and Hamas and Israel are both due to respond today. But part of that proposal is that the Palestinian Authority are going to negotiate on behalf of Palestine, on behalf of Palestinians. And it's not even counting Hamas as part of the discussions. And as we've seen in the north, that unless you bring all sides to the table, then you're not going to get any kind of a solution.
Yeah, no matter whether you want to speak to them or not.
Exactly.
They need to be
there.
Indeed, but unfortunately, Hamas themselves rejected the Egyptian-authored peace proposal.
Well, they weren't a part of it.
Well, you know, I mean, I think
they didn't go far enough to solve that. They'd be back practically at square one again.
One of the things, going back to something though, Alison said, you know, and you said yourself, it is very emotive. And I think what tends to happen is that the debate, particularly in the West, gets polarised, and you have different kind of sponsor groups and cheerleading groups for different elements. And I'm just even looking at in Ireland how polarised the debate gets. And, you know, unfortunately, I think the Palestinian solidarity movement don't do themselves any favours sometimes, the way they start to want to batter the debate. And if you don't take their, and indeed, like, you know, the Israelis also, so you have terms like anti-Semite and inhuman being thrown around when people try to have a rational discussion about it. And one of the things we have to bear in mind, look, there is no defence. Alison is right. It is barbaric to use the kinds of munitions, knowing that even if you're not targeting them directly, knowing that civilians are going to die is a byproduct of this, especially when you have the means through the dome to be able to protect your civilian population. That is a big difference. But, you know, those of us who are not at the end of the firing line, it behoves us to look at it a little bit more rationally and realise just because Hamas are not as efficient at killing Israelis, it doesn't take them off the moral hook. And we can't forget that civilians have been used by both sides as bargaining chips here. Hamas using, and as was the case in South Lebanon up until the April agreement in the 90s, launching rockets from near civilian areas, knowing that this is going to have this disproportionate and incorrect response from the Israelis. Yeah. So, like, you know, there's a number of people at fault here, and we have to keep that in mind. And we should remember, as Europeans, that we helped create some of this because we were the paymasters to the new Palestinian state when Yasser Arafat brutalised his own people with his secret police and pushed them into the arms to vote for Hamas and gave them the ground. Because the Palestinians weren't in love with the notion of extremism. They didn't have a lot of time for Hamas, but when they were the only alternative and they seemed more honest than the Fatah movement that was led by Yasser Arafat. And nobody wants to talk about
that. That's an interesting element.
Oh, no. Well, the Palestinian Solidarity Movement don't want to talk about that either.
Listen,
but that was Europe's fault.
We might move on here to the other big international story of the week, Constantine, I suppose, was the flight MH17. The bodies are gradually being returned to the families of victims. The EU is mulling over possible sanctions to be imposed on Russia. What's your view on this? Do you think sanctions need to be upped on Russia, and what impact will they have?
Well, it's a terrible tragedy. Most likely, we probably will not know major details about what has happened and what has led to it for quite a while. In the meantime, there is a huge amount of speculation, accusations, PR wars going on. and the huge amount of disinformation left, right and center, which is being negated and then confirmed and negated again and so forth. In the end, we probably will not know the full details and full picture, who is responsible and how it happened ever, most likely, with this type of the incidents where all of the sides involved have an interest in propagandizing and pushing their own agenda.
Has it been agreed it was originally Russian material that was used?
No, it hasn't been agreed. In fact, there's a conflict in evidence, left, right and center. If you look at what has been pretty much agreed now, and the physical evidence points fairly strongly in the direction that book type of the surface-to-air missiles has been used. However, both sides possess it. All three sides, actually, in the conflict possess it. Russia possesses it. Separatists possess it, and also the Ukrainian forces possess it. The origin of it is unclear. Ukraine accuses Russia of supplying it. Ukrainian separatists on June 29th posted photographs and reported directly to the media that they have taken possession of those missiles from the Ukrainian base that they have overrun. Ukrainian government claims now that those books were taken over by the separatists from the Ukrainian government, but they were disabled by the Ukrainian government and therefore not usable. Now, as far as the disabling military equipment goes, separatists are in the possession of a tank from the World War II, which was not only disabled, but set as a monument for about, 60 years plus, 70 years.
And they got it moving.
And they got it moving and they got it functioning now as well. What's even more important is that we don't even know how many books were in deployment in the area. There are claims and evidence that Russia produced, for example, that the Ukrainian forces had four book installments around the area of their own that they controlled, and that the separatists had one. Ukrainian forces denying that they had four, and so forth. So reality is that there's too much information flows which are gray at the very best and manipulated quite often as well by all of the sides in the conflict, and we don't know the truth about it. As far as the sanctions go, yes, European Union mulls the two rounds now of sanctions. The first round has been leaked yesterday, actually, to the Russian government and to the media as well. So we know those sanctions are in effect mirroring what Americans have passed before the incident itself. Now the European Union has delayed until the next week the deliberations on a second round or extension of those sanctions even further. Sanctions don't really work. They do induce some pain right now in the Russian economy, but the Russian economy is in slowdown before the conflict in Ukraine started and before the sanctions started, and it's suffering from a set of different conditions, including the structural crisis and growth and the
likes. So when you say they don't really work, do you think that does that mean that Putin is kind of, he just couldn't care less what sanctions are imposed?
It's not that he couldn't care less, but the problem with sanctions, especially when they're imposed against Russia, is that the sanctions are imposed against the conditions put onto Russia, in order to, which if Russia in theory satisfies those conditions, then Russia is scot-free in terms of the sanctions and the crisis gets diffused. The problem is that there are no conditions. We do not know what is exactly being demanded of Russia. De-escalation of conflict in the Ukraine. That might be completely out of hands of Russia today, because even if Russia did supply separatists in the past with military equipment and the advice and the likes, we have no idea if Russia has any control today or any influence over the separatists themselves. In the last couple
You'd
of weeks...
You have to suspect they do.
Well, no, but look, in the last couple of weeks, the separatists themselves started splitting left, right and center. This week we had, for example, an interview with one of the leaders of
separatist
movement.
You'd have to think that if Russia really put their mind to it, they could have an impact on what's going on there in Ukraine.
It's very difficult to say, okay? We don't know how far they can go with that. I'll give you several facts that we know of. One of the facts is this week there was a major interview with one of the leaders of the separatist movement there, which effectively was in two versions. An English version was translated as one, and the Russian version was translated as an entirely different one. In the English version, he very strongly opposes what would be the pro-Russian separatist position. He's breaking away from them completely. He's accusing them of firing the missiles. He's accusing them of effectively taking the military equipment from Russia and the likes. Kremlin and Moscow had absolutely no input in anything that this guy was saying. This is the second in command in the Donetsk Republic in the past. It's also a person with the largest number of troops behind him. There is a split ongoing within the different fractions in there. They're disorganized. They clearly cannot communicate. The downing of the jet itself was a complete and total mistake by them. And they now know that if they did that, you know, they're quite aware of that. It doesn't serve any of their purposes. And as a result of that, it very clearly shows that there is no central authority, no central coordination possible right now.
Declan, what's your take on everything that happened there?
I think there's an awful lot of what Constantine said is correct, although Constantine, I do think you're stretching it a bit to say that the Russians don't have the level of control. Most of the munitions and most of the any degree of the coordination that we've seen in this battle by the Donetsk People's Republic would have had to have some professional military input into it, including the launching of those missiles. I do think you've really articulated an important point. This is what happens, though, when you back a disparate group and you have splits. It's very hard to keep control of it. But and looking at the overall case, there's no you probably are right, I think, because not enough investigators didn't get access to the site of the crash when they should have. So that will always be in dispute. But if we look at it from the point of view that I think there is a prima facie case for Russia to answer, and certainly the Russian separatists, there was a Ukrainian transport plane operating in the area and where that airliner was shot down. There were a number of Ukrainian Air Force jets shot down. To my mind, I don't know of any Ukrainian launches of those missiles against the Russian separatists, because the Russian separatists weren't flying any aircraft. So far, what we have here is a case that's stacking up, that it's highly likely that it was Russian separatists with Russian provided in some shape or form munitions and personnel.
And even in the absence of absolute proof, it would seem that the rest of the world has more or less decided.
What's interesting about what happened in the last few days and about the EU was, I think, when this plane was downed and in the couple of days afterwards, everybody was so appalled that you would have imagined back then that far more would have happened by now. I think the sting in the political tail has really come out of the political tail with this whole thing of the delaying it till next week, the conversations, the meetings. The momentum has
bringing
really,
it all back down again.
Yeah, the momentum has really been lost.
Because it was a very personal tragedy that's been politicised an awful lot. I mean, we have to think about the 298 families who were affected by this, and how the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte has been one of the strongest, probably the strongest voice internationally in calling for further action against Russia or sanctions against Russia. He's very clear. The US, the UK have all been very clear that there does seem to be evidence to point to this being Russian, to be backed by Russia.
One thing, isn't it a good, from where I'm sitting, isn't it a good thing that there was a kind of a taking the sting out of things, that there wasn't a rush to start
a kind of hot-headed reaction?
I mean, we're seeing enough of that.
I don't think Constantine mentioned earlier about sanctions and how effective they were. I'm saying even that level, sting has been taken out of, let alone
sanctions are generally ineffective in modern geopolitics. Well, I mean, this really is effectively throwing cavalry against tanks.
There was a really interesting point by some German MPs this week about a different type of sanctions. They were talking about taking the World Cup away from Russia in 2018 and saying that these are the kind of sanctions, or this is the kind of punishment that you should be talking about against Russia.
That's an interesting point.
But also,
there are points that have been made. Now, Constantine might dispute this, and it is his field. But in the previous elements of this conflict, there were a lot of Russian troops massed along the border, and there was expected to be a conventional Russian incursion. And that didn't happen, and those troops were pulled back. And there was an argument made that there was a lot of sanctions and a lot of pressure being put on individual Russian energy companies by the US, that the US Treasury since 9/11 has been divested of its law enforcement roles and has been given greater roles in implementing financial pressure internationally, and that financial pressure put on these Russian companies, in turn they put pressure on Putin to back off a little bit.
Backdoor pressure.
I think there are things that are probably happening now with regards to financial pressures being brought to bear that we mightn't be fully aware of, and that is a good way to go. Rather than we're hearing the media and indeed others saying, "Well, something has to be done," we don't want to see a military response here.
Surely there's the point that this was an air crash where you had mainly Dutch people, but that had this international element, mm-hmm. and that there are certain international laws that covered that we all as human beings would wish to see respected. And the exact opposite of that happened in this. So I think it's almost like that a Rubicon was passed through just in relation to this one particular thing. An air crash, people lying dead.
In 1986, the Korean jet was shot by a pure accident, which led to a major escalation of the Cold War. De-escalation of that which happened due to the US administration playing a cool head in it, was very welcomed. It was a clear mistake. It was the case of a drunk, effectively, soldier kid, in Russian air traffic control military, basically targeting capabilities, who made a mistake. Subsequently, the downing of the Iranian jet by the United States took 8 years for them to pay the compensation, denying left, right, and center and evading everything else, was a mistake, was a tragic mistake, okay? Tragic mistakes in areas where there is a lot of tension do tend to happen. The fact that today, for example, Air Canada and the EasyJet had to divert from landing in Tel Aviv because of the rockets flying from Hamas.
Yeah,
nobody
is saying send troops into Hamas territory. I'm not calling for a major escalation of strikes.
Yeah. Where Declan was saying about the sanctions, there is an element of them working through the back doors, beyond a doubt. Second round in particular of the United States sanctions, actually third one, the last one, actually is having some impact. But overall, sanctions is not a resolution unless you have a very clear relationship between the demands and the ability of the other party to execute on those demands. And we don't have, in my view right now, that in the Ukraine.
Okay. Listen, let's move back to Irish politics with Christine, the cabinet held its last meeting yesterday. We're hearing now about an easier budget. It may not be 2 billion.
I think they use the word less demanding. So, I mean, you say an easier budget, but I mean, they're not being too positive about this. They're not trying to say it's going to be amazing to expect all this extra money in your pocket. It's going to be less demanding, which is probably, you know, the kind of damning it with faint praise, if anything. So don't be looking, I don't think anyone should be expecting to see, you know, extra 50s loading down their wallet after Christmas.
We have heard the words tax cuts, though, haven't we?
They're kind of floating it a little bit. They're kind of throwing it out there and saying, you know, there might be some kind of element of increasing, cutting the margin.
It would hardly be surprising at this point if they begin to ease off, Alison, would it, from a political point of view?
For me, you could be cynical with all the good news that came out of the cabinet meeting this week. For me, it was welcome in terms of it shows that the government is kind of getting its act together a bit. So in general, I think it's a good thing. I believe now that the Taoiseach should have issued an edict at the end of that meeting and told all of them they should go abroad for at least 2 weeks and not read an Irish newspaper or listen to an Irish radio or television station. I think that there's been, you know, it's been such an intense period, particularly after the elections. I think we would be far better served by our politicians that they get a very good break now.
They just
come back
need to
refreshed.
Kind of de-stress.
Yeah, I mean,
it's
I wouldn't
hear someone
be
saying that the TDs need to take more. But I mean,
you look.
Constantine, you're smiling.
I mean, the Taoiseach is going. I presume the Taoiseach is going to Kerry, as he does every year. I'd far prefer to see him in the Caribbean. You know,
I think if you're looking at the financial situation of this country, the room in the next budget for any adjustments downward in terms of the austerity is probably going to be somewhere in a negligible territory of between 500 million and maybe 800 million or so. Nobody will notice any effect of that on the economy. However, if we look down the road, when you look at the budgetary projection through 2018 by the EU, by the European Commission for Ireland and by the IMF for Ireland, out of the total adjustments that will have to take place and out of the changes and revenue and the expenditure side, 10.7 billion of those future changes are currently unallocated. We have only hope that they will materialize somehow. 4 billion, however, is allocated. If we start chipping into those 4 billion,
see,
we're going to put even more money on
the
hope.
When the sun is shining like this and we're in the middle of the summer, we've had years of this.
Does that answer your worries, Constantine?
We need to break
the sunshine.
Well, given this is Irish
the
summer, the sunshine will go away and the reality will come back very soon.
I think Alison has a point in the sense that the people who are the players on the pitch, the politicians, take them. Yeah, sometimes people need to step away from the cold face. But one consideration I'd have is that we've been through an awful lot and that there's a lot of pressure on the government, particularly I think the Labour Party, to try and manage optics now in the future. And I would hate to see things being done in the next budget that would be just a sop to people to try and retain maybe
just
you know,
to get a few positive
yeah, minor political advantages.
But that's clearly what's going to happen. I mean, the government's in the middle of its term. There's only going to be this budget and one more before the 2016 election. They're trying to sweet talk people at the moment. They're trying to remind them of why they voted Fine Gael and Labour in the first place in 2011. This is going to be a sop. This
at
is going to be them
doing
sweet talking.
Proper vitamin E levels.
Well, I'm always reminded of the quote from Churchill.
D, he said,
when you're in hell, the only thing to do is keep going. In other words, we've come this far through austerity. You know, we need to follow through, finish it off, and not try and take a shortcut that's going to bite us in the ass in the future.
And on that note, we're going to leave it. Look, thank you all very much indeed for coming into us this morning. Christine Bowen, Constantine Gurdjieff, Alison O'Connor and Declan Power.